Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favorite football podcast, back for another week, and with the Euros and the Copa America all wrapped up, it's time for us to start looking forward and to take a look at the teams who have done the best transfer business so far. I wanted to call this Clubhouse Leaders, but it felt a bit too golfy for us to use that as the title. But alas, the teams who have started this window well, who have got their business done early, who have started to put together a blueprint for what next year is going to look like. It's very, very exciting. My name's Jack Collins, and I'll be your host today. And joining me from across the water, Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Hello, mate. Yeah, beautiful, beautiful day in sunny San Diego, as always, as I'm sure it is over there in
England. It's actually quite nice today, to be fair.
Oh, is it? Finally, yesterday. The rain videos are going to stop. Every day I'm just getting videos of people saying, "Bet you don't miss this," and just a video of the rain in their garden.
Yesterday, the storm broke, and I was like, wow, I don't think I've seen rain like this. Like, it's been raining all the time, but I haven't seen rain like this for a while. It was really bleak. Welcome, I nearly said your video, to be fair.
Yes, I'm not missing rain, but I'm enjoying the life, mate. It's all good. But I guess let's start off with things we love. And I was hoping, obviously, today I'll be talking about loving the fact I've just watched England win their first trophy of my lifetime. But alas, I'm not. I'm talking about our manager leaving instead, and on the back of a predictable somewhat defeat. Gareth Southgate gone after 102 games, 8 years in charge. I mean, it's probably a bit harsh to say I love it, but I'm ready for it. It's going to be a difficult transition. Like, you're torn over what Southgate's done here as an Englishman, because he has given us occasions that we'd never had before, like the country coming to a standstill. There's a video taken from like a rooftop in London at the weekend when Cole Palmer scored, and you can just hear roars all across London. Like, that's really cool. And like, he's helped get us to moments like that. But obviously it hasn't been that thrilling. I guess for me and you, it reminded me a little bit of like when Roy Hodgson was in charge of Fulham. Like, it wasn't the most thrilling football all the time, but like, it was pretty safe and predictable and usually had a decent outcome.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I've kind of been trying to look at it like that and being like, look, if we win it, we win it. Like, however we win it now, it doesn't matter. But look, this tournament didn't have the same feel as when we lost the last final. Like, losing to Italy on penalties was painful, because I genuinely felt we should have won that tournament. Once we got there and we got in front as well in that final, defeat was really hard to take. The Spain one hasn't actually caused me that much pain, because we weren't that good in the tournament and we didn't deserve to win the final. So I don't really have any real like hangover from it. But we might have a hangover from the Gareth Southgate era, because it is now time to dive in and explore the possibilities of who comes next now that he's resigned. So there are a few names being bandied about, and the main ones that are to be considered first are Eddie Howe, Graham Potter, Lee Carsley, Mauricio Pochettino. They're the main four. As outsiders, you'll get people like Thomas Tuchel, who will be keen on the job. A couple of people I've heard try to throw Lampard and Gerrard into the mix, but I think that's more as like, maybe it's worth having one of these guys like in the structure, not as manager, but in the structure. And maybe, but
I've been banging the drum for Frank Lampard to become the England under 21s manager forever. So I feel like it would be disingenuous for me to change tack from that now.
Yeah, I just don't like, they were attached with so much failure themselves that I'm just not sure it's even worth having them anywhere near the dressing room. I want a clean cut from all of this. And Southgate obviously had attachments to failure too. And even though he's tried to bring back glory and done better than anyone else has to get back there, like, it still hasn't ended well. Eddie Howe, for me, is the front runner. There's been a lot of admiration from within the FA setup for Howe for a long time. and he's definitely one of the strongest candidates for this job. Newcastle don't want him to go in this moment, but equally, I think that Newcastle could look at it as a positive, because they were considering, you know, very briefly a few months back, like, what if we do part ways with Howe? Where would we go? People like Roberto Mancini potentially in the frame of trying to find them a proven winner. So Howe, I do think, will be somebody that they look at very closely. And he would obviously consider becoming the England manager. Graham Potter, been out of work since leaving the Chelsea job over a year ago. Obviously, he's going to want the job. Is he ready for it? I'm not convinced he is, but I can understand why some people might believe that he's got the right kind of personality and nature for this job. Lee Carsley, obviously the England under 21 boss at the moment, I think he'll get a chance. I think he'll get an opportunity to at least pitch his thoughts and ideas around what he could do for this job, you know, but never having managed a big men's team, like, is quite a significant thing, because it's one thing being under 21 boss and having good credentials at that level. But when you step it up and you're having to deal with a different level of ego, players at a different stage of their career, different fallouts, bigger decisions, bigger scrutiny, that would be a big, big call to make Lee Carsley England manager. And Mauricio Pochettino, if we're going to go non-English, then obviously, like, it's got to be someone that's got some attachment to English football. And obviously, have him himself left Chelsea at the end of last season, is available, is a good manager. I think the FA would prefer to go homegrown. I do think that that's the stance that they'll go for, but they're not going to rule out outside managers if that's what it comes to. So it's a really tough decision. But Southgate's gone, so we've got to face up to it. And my main concern, Jack, is that none of those people I've mentioned are like winners. None of them. You know,
where are we even going with this?
It's a very, very good chance that the next manager is nowhere near as good as Gareth Southgate. That's the problem we got.
It's hard, isn't it? It's a bit careful what you wish for. And I absolutely get that. It's a funny one when you kind of look at it. And I think it comes down to something. There's a piece in The Guardian today by Barney Rone. And look, it's taken some criticism and some hits, and rightly so, because I think some of it is a little bit disingenuous around the idea of, you know, what English football represents, what it is, et cetera, et cetera. And that's fine. But it's a weird one, because there is no, and one of the points he makes in it, there is no English coaching school. It doesn't exist, right? So when you're looking to bring someone through and be like, well, we want to follow in the same kind of model, what model, right? You look at the different things. I'm not saying that every Spanish manager manages in the same way. I think you put Guardiola and Bordalas in a room and they could argue until the cows come home about the right way to play football, right? Mm. But I think there is a sense of being like, well, there is a school of coaching in Italy. There is a school of coaching in the Netherlands. There is a school of coaching in Portugal. There is a school of coaching in Spain. And that doesn't mean that everybody has exactly the same ideas about how to play football, but it means that there is a constant flow of managerial talent coming through. And I do wonder if the kind of draw of the Premier League, and, you know, when you spoke about it at the start of last season, actually, you were like, three of the four or four of the five best managers in the world are now managing in the Premier League. And that's exciting. And I thought it was interesting as a comment, because none of those managers are English. And I wonder if there is a space here that you go, well, what's the gap? And is that why this is a problem? Because there is no school of coaching that translates into success from an English perspective. And you're looking at the English managers who have medals. The list is paper thin, right? Like, you can't look at it that way and be like, well, these players have, or this manager has won this for, or gone elsewhere and learned from different places. And I find it really intriguing that this conversation is now coming up, because yes, Eddie Howe is a good manager and I like him. And I think he's done a relatively good job at Newcastle. And like you say, you know, maybe he's not going to be the person that takes Newcastle to their final form, but equally, you know, he's done an okay job. But hasn't really won anything. You look at someone like Sean Dyche, who I think is a wonderful manager at the level he manages at, or at least for the very specific clubs that take on a Sean Dyche style of football. He's very effective and does what he sets out to do, but he's not winning anything. You kind of come to this conclusion that, you know, where is this decision? And maybe that's where Potter's a bit different, because he obviously went abroad and applied his trade abroad to try and learn different ideas and try and expand that palette a little bit more. But that's where I get to. And it comes back to this over and over again, that there isn't this kind of school of successful English managers. And until that's fixed, I think it's going to be very hard to find a manager who's going to be like, okay, I'll come in and do that and be the person to get over the line, because I know how to do that at club level, or I know how to do that. And look, Carlsley might be the answer because he's done it at under 21 level. Mm-hmm. And look, that frustrates me because, you know, obviously Ireland made an approach. He played for Ireland coming through and he turned that down. So that's obviously quite hard to swallow in some ways. But equally, I do kind of get it, because at least it's a continuation pathway that makes sense in that regard.
Yeah, obviously, like, the FA do like pathways, and they like to open up avenues and have people that understand the system and the expectations and things like that.
Southgate should become a technical director. If the FA have anything, you know, about their oversee coaching and development.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, St George's Park. Like, allow that pathway to take place. Use that knowledge that he's gained and gleaned from the last 8 years and put it to work. If I was in charge of the FA, that's exactly what I would be doing right now.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine he'll end up in a Premier League job at some point in the not so far distant future. But for now, he's probably... feels like the lightest man in the country, because he's been carrying the country on his shoulders for the last 4 or 5 weeks. And I reckon that when he announced that he was resigning, he would have felt a hell of a lot lighter and a hell of a lot more relieved that he can get back to a somewhat more normal life for a little bit. But look, De La Fuente obviously has just led Spain to success. I mean, what he doesn't have major credentials in club football. His pathway has been coming through the Spain youth setups, so it can work. In England, there's different expectations, different pressures, which are not helpful by any stretch of the imagination, but they do exist, and that's probably the main barrier to Carsley getting it. But it's going to be interesting, mate. If I've to go rogue, I mean, I was laughing at the USMNT last week and Jurgen Klopp, and obviously in the days that followed that, that became an even bigger story, and the US did make a tentative approach to get Jurgen Klopp. Jurgen Klopp as England manager would be an absolute dream.
Yeah, absolutely. I just can't see him taking it.
If you want a winner, and you can't get Guardiola, Mourinho, once upon a time, I think, would have probably been there to do it, but I don't think that moment is now. It would be good, because he gets it. He gets the Englishness. He understands the pressures. But obviously, he's just walked away from Premier League football because he's kind of sick of having all that pressure. I don't think taking this job would help him.
Yeah, I just can't see it in a million years.
That's the dream one for me, I think, right now, though, because a realistic-ish dream would be for Jurgen Klopp to get it.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to be taking any jobs for the foreseeable future. But also, I just think that there is a sense... I agree with you for maybe different reasons. I think that kind of his ability to connect with a fan base and to speak for the voiceless, etc., I think is something that Southgate did really well. And it was the reason that a lot of people were drawn to Gareth Southgate and what he stood for. I think Klopp would be in a similar mold, but I think you're a world away, if I'm honest. I'd be absolutely stunned if Jurgen Klopp took the England job. So we shall see. Let's move on, because I want to just briefly talk about the team of the tournament for the Euros before we go on to transfers, which was released today by the UEFA Technical Observer Panel, as they are known. And they've selected, obviously, their 11 players for the Liga tournament. I just want to read out the panel, right? So the panel was Fabio Capello, Ioan Lupescu, who's a Romanian legend, Michael O'Neill, David Moyes, Alyosha Asanovic, Rafael Benitez, Avram Grant, Paki Bonner, Frank de Boer, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, Aitor Karanka, and Jean-Francois Domergue. So some very talented individuals in there, not only on a playing sense, but also from a coaching sense. I am stunned by some of this. Absolutely stunned. Because their team of the tournament is this. It's Mike Maignan in goal. Marc Cucurella, left back. William Saliba, at left centre back. Manuel Akanji at right centre back. Kyle Walker at right back. Rodri, Ruiz and Olmo in the middle. Williams on the left wing. Yamal on the right wing. Musiala through the middle as a centre forward. So one, you know, we talk about in England a lot, sometimes Garth Crooks makes teams of the weeks for the BBC and they don't make any sense. The players are in the wrong positions. He's playing three at the back with three fullbacks in there. It's chaos. It's become kind of a meme in itself. What is going on here? Like, Jamal Musiala had a very good tournament. Fine. No bother whatsoever. Like, with Musiala being involved in this. Musiala at centre forward? No, honestly, thank you. Yeah, no,
that's
thank
the
you.
Weird one, yeah.
Cody Gakpo, I think you could have just about shoehorned into the centre forward, right? I know played a lot of his games on the wing, but Cody Gakpo has played at times as a centre forward, right? Especially when the Netherlands switched shape and whatnot. I think you could have just about got away with Gakpo in there. I'm not sure you can get away with Musiala at centre forward. But what on earth is going on at right back? Kyle Walker at right back. Like, there's been some different criticisms leveled at England over the last few days, right? A lot of people have been blaming Southgate. A lot of people have been blaming different players. Harry Kane's got a lot of stick. The one thing I think England fans have been pretty universal about is that Kyle Walker had a dreadful tournament. And it's sort of, to see him in here, At first, I was like, "Nah, it's surely got to be a joke. Like, someone's obviously put the wrong name in, and or they've adapted it for like Twitter." I went on the UEFA website and I was like, "Oh no, they've actually put him in." They're some of the brightest tactical minds on the planet. How on earth are they justified putting Kyle Walker in this team? I'm absolutely flabbergasted. And you know, as our friend of the pod, Mark Geshwin, said to me on Twitter when I posted about this, he was like, "I could understand if there was no other standout right backs across the tournament, but both Jules Koundé and Danny Carvajal, absolutely brilliant through the whole tournament." Like, it just, I mean, maybe Carvajal misses out because he got sent off. And, you know, obviously, I think Demiral could have been a shout for here, but he also got suspended for, you know, off-pitch matters. And
that scored probably an own goal, rules him out. Against him.
Just seems absolutely, but it wasn't an own goal though. Went down as almost goal. Can't even hold that against him. Like, putting him in, and look, I can absolutely understand the need to put an England player in, but put Mark Gay in. Like, Manuel Akanji would not be mad for not being in the team of the tournament. He got knocked out in the quarterfinals. Like, it's not that deep. I think that if I was to make a couple of changes, I would have Koundé at right centre back. I'd have Gay in next to Saliba, and that'd be fine. I think Demiral will be unlucky to miss out, but it is what it is. And maybe Stefan de Vrij a little bit as well. And I think I would have had Mamardashvili in goal because Maignan was good. Pickford was pretty good as well. Yeah. But I think that what Mamardashvili did and the big saves he came up with to get Georgia through the group stage in their first time ever at a tournament, I think justifies his inclusion when there wasn't another standout goalkeeper. So I'm okay with Maignan being in there because I thought he was fine. And he's a brilliant goalkeeper at the best of times. But I would have had Mamardashvili and I would have had Cody Gakpo through the middle. But I just could not believe that Kyle Walker was in this team. It like absolutely threw me. I thought it was some sort of like joke. I thought April Fool's Day was a couple of months ago. Like, surely someone's having me on.
I mean, if you were to rank the top 10 England players from this tournament, Walker wouldn't be in the list. He wouldn't.
No.
He was a liability. I like Kyle Walker. He's been a great player for us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Through the years and all that. But there's absolutely no way he was the best right back at this kind of, I mean, didn't even play there half the time in the end. So look, it is what it is. They've obviously felt the need to have an England player in there because we were in the final. But like you say, Gehi would have been a great pick because he was brilliant and deserves probably a big transfer on the back of that tournament because, he did not let us down at all. Whereas Walker very nearly did very many times. So maybe next time they just need to do like it, just do it on X or something. Just do like do a poll because you'll get a better team. I think I honestly think you could have put polls up on X or on UEFA's website. And the people could have come up with a better team than these experts because it's just not right. It's wrong.
Well, they were the ones that also picked Rodri's team of their player of the tournament. And I am still very angry that Fabian Ruiz has been absolutely snubbed here because for me, the player of the tournament. But anyway, talking of transfers, should we come on to the main segment of the show? We're going to be talking about all of the teams who have done that business early after the break. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Ranks FC. It's time for our main ranking, and I'm delighted, sir. I'm just handing the floor over to Mr. Dean Jones. We're going to be talking transfers. I've got a couple of honourable mentions at the end, but this main ranking comes all the way from San Diego.
It does, yeah. Obviously, I have been in transfer mode throughout the Euros, throughout the Copa America. Congratulations to Argentina, by the way, who we haven't mentioned on this podcast yet, but did win the tournament at the weekend. So congrats there. If you want to hear more about that, we did a full breakdown of it all on Patreon on Monday. So get yourselves over there if you're not a member already. The link is in the description. But yeah, today we're just going to go through five clubs that have made a really fast start in the transfer window with some great business. Some of it expected, some of it not, but I've gone 5-1 to decide what I think are the best deals of the summer so far. At five, I've gone for Juventus. It's a really defining summer for Juventus. Obviously, they took the decision to part ways with Allegri before the end of last season, which was definitely the right decision. And now we're moving into the Thiago Motta era, and they need a quick start and they need to quickly find an identity. And three strong signings so far. Douglas Luiz has come in, Kefren Thuram has come in too for the midfield, and Di Gregorio has come in as the new goalkeeper. Three great, great signings. A new midfield feels like an absolute godsend. And we know that they also still want to add fresh spark to the attack as well. They've looked into deals like Jadon Sancho already this summer, and even though that's not going to work out, they'll continue to consider somebody that could give them new life. Obviously, Illing Jr. Left the club, and I think that little deals like that are important too. It's not just the incoming business for Juventus that's been good. It's the outgoings as well, just kind of getting rid of, or at least trying to get rid of right now, players that just don't fit anymore. And at a time when you'd be looking at McKennie and Rabiot and Arthur and thinking, what is the makeup of this team going to be going forward? You just need a clean slate. And getting Douglas Luiz in and Kefren Thuram is an unbelievable start to try to fix all of that. And to be honest, I think, Jack, early signs that this is a side that are looking to seriously challenge Inter Milan next season. I mean, it goes without saying that that is going to be the aim, but this actually, with Motta coming in as well and, you know, having some say on how he wants the identity of this team to look, he might not have got in Xerxes like he wanted. He might not have yet got Calafiori either like he wanted. But Juve showing that they're going to back their man, and that finally Juve might actually be entertaining as well.
Yeah, I think this is it. It's about refreshing the slate here. And I think by the end of last season, Juve's midfield started to look very tired. Just in terms of what it was about and who was in it and what it all looked like. It was a kind of strange place for them to be. And obviously, Charlie Alcaraz came in from Southampton on loan, and I wondered if they were going to make that permanent. Obviously, Adrian Rabiot has been there for so long. He's now left on a free, currently without a club, but it will be interesting to see where kind of he ends up. But you kind of look at what's going on here with this midfield. Kefren Thuram, as you say, young but very, very impressive, 23 years old, following in the footsteps of his father, obviously playing for Juventus, which is a nice one to have in. And then Dougie Luiz, who's a little bit more experienced at 26, but has been absolutely brilliant, lights out for Aston Villa last year and really was one of the best midfielders in the Premier League, I think, across that. And there'll be a lot of people who have looked at that deal and thought, oh, maybe we thought we could have got hold of him. Arsenal obviously kind of perennially linked to Dougie Luiz, but he's gone now. I think that this kind of represents that fresh start. And Locatelli's in there as well. I have a feeling that Locatelli's importance is going to increase over the course of this season. But in Thuram, Luiz, Locatelli, and then obviously Fagioli and Moretti as well, who are two very young, very talented footballers. Fagioli obviously missed a lot of last season with that ban. But has shown that he's going to be back into the fold. And Moretti at 20 years old as well. Very, very exciting times, I think, when you kind of look at what this squad has in it now in midfield. That feels like a really good, strong core for Motta to work with. And as you say, I think it's about setting the foundations. And suddenly you're like, well, okay, what's the defense look like? Well, Bremer is phenomenal. We know that. It's not any news to us to have seen that. Federico Gatti looks like he's not going to be leaving anymore. It looks like he's going to sign a new contract. They could probably do with a little bit of help at right and left back, I think, just in terms of improving those. But Cambiasso has come into this squad and looks really, really good on that left. So it's going to be interesting to see how much he plays next season. And then there is that opportunity to refresh the attack. Di Gregorio, though, I think is a really, really smart, sensible signing. And there's a lot of talk of Chesney leaving this summer, and everyone was sort of curious as to what that would look like. They've brought in, for me, one of the best goalkeepers in Serie A last season with Monza. I thought he was pretty, you know, lights out for them over the last couple of years. And the way that he's adapted to life, you know, back in Serie A after coming up with Monza in 21-22 has been pretty stunning. I think he's made that look incredibly easy. And coming in here now to potentially be Juve's first choice goalkeeper, there's a real nice synchronicity about that, I think, with what Motta wants and what he wants from his goalkeepers. So I'm really excited. I'm surprised they're at five, to be honest, because I think this has been pretty lights out business. I'm really, really impressed with what Juve have done so far. They need a few more things to kind of find their way in order to make things tick perfectly. But as a start, I don't think you could have asked for much more than this for Juve.
Yeah, look, they were unwatchable at times last season, and I would suggest that's not going to be the case any longer as Motta gets his hands on this team and starts to bring in a few new tools to the box. I think it's going to be a lot more fun to watch Juve, and I'd say that success is not going to be too far away. Douglas Luiz particularly, like, that's such a good pickup. Like, I didn't think anyone would get Douglas Luiz out of Aston Villa. A few clubs in England had a little try. So important to them in my eyes, but Juve have done really well to make that signing. I'm going to move on to number four, possibly the surprise of the list, really, because maybe it's just flown under the radar. Maybe people don't really realise how significant this might end up being because they're not really household names at the moment. But four, I've got Brighton, who have set about, as usual, early business and identifying mostly young talent, emerging talent, but also top talent. Yankuba Minte signed from Newcastle United. Mats Wiefer signed from Feyenoord. Ibrahim Osman has signed from Norgesland. These are really, really good signings. Look, I'm going to start with Minte. At 30 million, they've taken advantage of a situation at Newcastle, obviously, who have needed to meet PSR targets. Minte would have been in Newcastle's plans this season. Eddie Howe's quite disappointed to lose him because he had plans to get him involved. He'd been on loan at Feyenoord last season, and by all accounts, Brighton kept a really close eye on him across that loan spell and felt, you know, if there's an opportunity to get this guy in the future, let's go for it. He was playing, obviously, for Arne Slot, who's the new Liverpool manager, and mostly used in the front three out wide. We'll have to wait to see exactly what his Brighton role will be, but this is a guy who's got plenty of pace. He's direct in his running, direct with the ball, technically very, very good. He's got all the traits and all the assets that you would expect a player to have that's going to come into Brighton and shine. I'm quite excited to see actually him make this move because I think it's the perfect place for him to take the first proper steps into the Premier League, even though he's obviously been technically at a Premier League club for a while. As for Wiefer, like, this is probably the best signing of the three. Possibly.
I think it is for the right now. I think in a couple of years, we might not be saying that. But also, you know, just on this one, and just to kind of link those two signings together, obviously, Mensa spent last season at Feyenoord with Mats Wiefer. So not only have you got a 19-year-old coming into the dressing room and being like, okay, I'm back in the Premier League, you've also got him in there with someone that he spent the last season with, which should help both to settle, I think.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, absolutely. That'll definitely help them and can lean on each other through while they're both settling in, really. You know, it's not easy ever to make a transfer and settle into a new environment. So to have some familiarity is definitely going to be handy. We've signed a 5-year deal, about £25 million he came for in the end. Would have been in the Euros, but injury ruled him out. He's back now. And obviously, Brighton never really replaced Moise Caicedo. And this is finally fixing that, I think. You know, he's going to come into this, I would expect, flawlessly. And I think that it will only be a matter of time before there are discussions saying, oh, why didn't Man United sign him? Why didn't Chelsea sign him? Blah, 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 blah. Why didn't Arsenal sign him? And it'll probably be a valid argument too, because at £25 million, Brighton have probably made one of the best pickups so far that we've seen this summer. Just in terms of like where Brighton's vision is. There was some interesting quotes from David Weir, who's the technical director at Brighton, who says he has a lot of experience in the Champions League as well as the Eredivisie, and is developed into one of the best deep-lying midfield players in Europe. We've already got quite a few Dutch players here, and they'll help Matt settle into the club. And we're excited about what he can achieve here. So clearly, you know, Brighton identifying this type of player, watching these types of games, seeing which players can become part of this crop, which, as he said, they do have a few Dutch players already in there.
Yeah, Jean-Paul Van Hecke and obviously Bruggen. Who has obviously been the Netherlands number one across the course of the Euros. And I wonder, you know, I think he will take the number one jersey at Brighton next year. And, you know, obviously wears that on his back. But I think he will be kind of undisputed number one by the time we're discussing this next season. It does feel like a really good crop of players that they've brought in here. And I've been very, very impressed with how they've gone about their business. I mean, it's nothing new, right? We're not sitting here saying anything that people don't know. Brighton are very, very good at this kind of thing, and they have been for some time. Mint is obviously the kind of headline, I think. Vifa might be the one who makes the most impact. And I thought it was bang on what you said about Caicedo. They never really sat in and replaced that hole. And I think it's given some space for certain players to actually express themselves. And it's given Billy Gilmore in particular, I think, that space to kind of have a go and make that role his own, which he's done really well. They're going to lose Mahmoud Dahoud, who's gone off already after a year. And it's going to be interesting to see how they kind of fill that gap. James Milner role obviously kind of diminished and going into the coaching staff. So how they fill that gap in midfield is always going to be the kind of big question here. Belabas had a really good first season. Pairing him with Wefa, I think, really puts them in a good spot. There's two more here that I think are really interesting as well, in Ibrahim Osman and Malik Yalkuye. Now, obviously, I haven't watched all that much of Nordjylland or Göteborg, so I've kind of done my research on these two as opposed to anything else. But it does feel like they've got this eye for spotting talent really early on. Yalkuye in particular, I think, he's only been at Göteborg for 6 months. He came in January and immediately wandered into the team and immediately was sort of a player that you could keep an eye on. And once, you know, the hype started to flow, I tried to watch a bit of him on my scout and the like to try and expand on what he is. And he's still quite small for a box-to-box midfielder. He's still, you know, a number eight. He doesn't look like he has that physical profile yet. But in terms of getting around, smashing into people, breaking up play, there's a real player in there. And when he gets the ball, he's a lovely dribbler. He moves through the phases really nicely. And I think that when you kind of put all of that into a package and be like, okay, here's a place for you to actually develop physically, I think, which is an important moment in terms of what it looks like, but also kind of learn your trade and what bits of the game you're good at and what bits of the game you have to almost leave to other people. That's going to be the really interesting thing for Yalkuye. And Osman is someone who has been around on the European scene a little bit longer, but also as someone who's kind of exploded into life. And Ernest Nuemar obviously made that move from Nordjylland to Lyon. And hasn't really set the place on fire yet, but there's always those glimpses of the talent. And I think that Osman's another one who has that ability to make things happen. It's interesting to see which clubs are picking up talent from Norway, from Denmark, you know, and from Sweden in this case. It really is intriguing to see how they develop that and what it looks like. Because obviously we saw Yasin Ayari come in a year ago for Brighton and then basically spend the entire time out on loan. He went to Coventry and then to Blackburn. Did okay for both. Really quite interesting, but 20 years old, and they kind of signed him just as Caicedo was leaving, and everyone was like, oh, is he going to be the replacement? And it felt early. But I do think that, you know, what that year where he's just gone and been out on loan and learned, I wouldn't be surprised if one or maybe both of Osman and Yalkuye go out on loan. But at the moment, it just feels like they're kind of in that space where they're exploring, you know, the space and that kind of talent factory that is there in the Scandinavian countries. And it's something very, very impressive in so many ways. The other youngster is obviously Amario Kozier-Dubery, who has come from the Arsenal Academy, was kind of seen as one of the big talents in that academy. And I saw our good friend Harry Brooks, head coach of this podcast, talking about this on Twitter, and he was saying, I can't see him going in there to be playing for Brighton's academy. I can't see him going in there to be in the first team picture straight away. So it's interesting where they're shopping as opposed to other people. But this is why the Brighton model is so successful.
Yeah, absolutely is. Right, let's move on to number three, where we do have another Premier League side in my ranking. They've made six signings already. It's Aston Villa. Ian Mattson's, I guess, the headline act because he cost 40 million, which is a pretty big deal. They brought Jordan Archer back. They've got Illing Jr. in. Dobbins come in. I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, but they brought in Baranekia. Is that right, Jack?
I'm not 100% sure. I would have probably said Baranechea, but I'm pretty sure that's the kind of Argentinian pronunciation of it. So I'm not 100% sure that's right. So I'm afraid I'm going to have to defer until we know more.
Okay, we'll find out more during pre-season. And Ross Barkley's also coming for Aston Villa, who you'd have to say are winning the transfer window in England as it stands. But we all know that can be a bit of a curse. So watch your step, Aston Villa. Don't sign anybody else because you're having way too good a time of things at the moment. Look, Unai Emery will be delighted. He wanted backing in this window. He wanted to make sure that this team moves forward, progresses, matches his vision. He's getting all of it right now. The only thing he didn't get was to keep Douglas Luiz. Obviously, I talked about him joining Juventus already. I do see that as a slight blow, but I do think that obviously it helped them financially. And bear in mind, they've also managed to get rid of some players that they were keen to do so, like Coutinho and stuff. So Aston Villa are having a good time of things at the moment. I think they face a situation around Diaby. I'm getting a lot of messages that he wants out of the club at the moment. And so we'll have to keep an eye on his situation. But if he goes, then they'll just replace him. And there'll be plenty of scope to do that because that's already been something that they've been looking at. There's been so many links with attackers in Emery's time at Aston Villa. So it'd be interesting to see who he actually would go for in the end. As another attacking figure. But yeah, in terms of the kind of profile of player that they're signing, fixing positions, and kind of just surprising us all a little bit with the intensity of their business, I have been quite impressed with the way that Villa have gone about things.
Yeah, I think it's been, obviously some of it's been forced, right, by PSR regulations. And I also don't want to sit here after criticising those regulations and the way that clubs are getting around them and the fact that young players have been moved on for fees above perhaps their station, which puts undue pressure on them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I can't sit here and be like, oh, I'm really glad that, you know, Tim Rogbenham has gone to Everton for £10 million because I don't think that's a particularly good bit of business for anybody, including Tim, because now there's a £10 million price tag on his head and I'm not sure he's ready for that step just yet. You know, you could say the same for Lewis Dobbin coming the other way for £11 million. Yeah, good player, has done shown some signs of life in an Everton shirt and done some good things, but equally, yeah. Is he a £10 million player yet? I don't know. I don't know if we've seen enough of that. So
I don't know what a £10 million player is anymore.
No, it's true. It's true. And in today's market, that almost feels like really cheap. But equally, I think Baranechea has done more in his time so far. And he was only, £5 million, £6 million. But equally, that was a double deal. So who knows what all of it's worth in kind of in itself. But yeah, I'm impressed by what they've done. I mean, I assume there are going to be some outgoings with Maartsen coming in because you can't have Luca Dean and Alex Moreno and Ian Maartsen all competing for the left-back slot. It's not going to make any sense. Having two players for a position is good. Three feels like a lot. I'm really pleased Cameron Archer's gone back because I think he's an incredibly talented footballer. Still hoping he has an Irish nan somewhere. But generally, that deal felt like it was always going to be pulled off if Sheffield United were relegated. So that was a bit of a strange one. Eiling Jr. is an incredibly exciting player. And look, in Eiling Jr. and Dobbin, obviously there's two players in there so that even if DRB goes, there is now kind of there are other players here who are potentially going to be able to step up. And more than that, it looks like Jadon Philogene might return as well. So it's a hard kind of space to be in. But equally, I think that they're managing what they need to do really well. And I don't think they would have expected both Douglas Luiz and DRB to be pushing for exits, especially after qualifying for the Champions League. But sometimes that's just the way it goes, right? And I think that this Saudi deal for DRB seems like it's an incredible amount of money. So you can't sort of hold that against him in so many ways. But it feels to me that they're still short a centre-back. And that's where I think it's going to be interesting to see. Obviously, they lost Clement Longley off to loan, and Callum Chambers didn't play very much last year, but he was still part of the squad. And he's gone off to Cardiff on a free transfer. I think they're a little bit light in there now, maybe one player light, especially with the injury record that they had last year and not trying to rush some of those players back. I think it's going to be important for them to bring in one more centre back. But, you know, on the whole, it feels like Aston Villa are starting to get the depth right for what's going to be a very difficult campaign. Obviously, they played in the Conference League and they went deep in it last year. The Champions League is obviously a step up from that in terms of quality. But also, there's more Champions League games in the groups than there have ever been before because of this new system that's coming in. A lot of players here will have either played, gone deep into the Copa America or deep into the Euros, and they're going to have to, you know, work out how those players are nursed back to fitness. And I wonder if all of that fatigue plays a part at the end of this season. If Villa want to step on and kick on and, you know, maintain their position as a Champions League club for next season, it's going to take a lot of depth. And I think they're filling out that squad quite nicely.
Yeah, they are. I mean, obviously, when you're competing at that level, you need a certain level of experience, which is going to be not easy to find. And I'm interested. I mean, what do you make of Jadon Philogene? Because obviously, this is a player that has been identified too. And I'm slightly concerned that some of the players that they're going for aren't obviously like going to come in and make all the difference. And that's why I presume that, say, the RB does end up going to Saudi, which I think he will, there's still other players to come in of like top level caliber, because there seems to be a few like emerging players rather than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, they're clearly going for a strategy here that prioritises youth. And we've just spoken about Juve and Brighton both doing this and saying, you know, we want players that are going to grow in and that we'll be able to sell for a profit. Obviously, Villa are going to be able to give minutes to these players. Obviously, it's a risky strategy. I'm not suggesting by any stretch of the imagination that everyone's going to be like, oh, they're going to slot in seamlessly and every single one of them is going to be a success. But I think in terms of, you know, you only need two or three of these to be a major success and flip for profit to be able to justify that strategy. And that seems the way that Villa are going about this. Also, there's a lot of players who know the club, right? They're coming back. Cameron Archer coming back. Jadon Philogene will be coming back. It's not like they're coming into new environments where they don't know anyone and wouldn't feel comfortable. I mean, much as I think that players having to be sold and then bought back by their parent club for PSR reasons is absolutely bizarre, and I don't think it sets a particularly good precedent for anybody, I think that the idea of them bringing back players who are already comfortable within the training complex, who will have friends there, who know people in the club, all of that is probably a major bonus for Aston Villa.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good point. And yeah, so I put them in at three because I think that like they've shown great intent with the type of players. And obviously someone like Ross Barkley too is going to add a level of depth and expertise. And actually last season at Luton, we saw some really good performances from Ross Barkley.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad he hasn't gone to like a super club. And I don't mean that with any disrespect to Aston Villa, because I think the pressure on him when he obviously went to Chelsea that time really played on his mind. I think that when he played for England, we often didn't see the best out of Barkley in an England shirt. Villa feels like a really good fit, and I feel like Emery's a really good manager for Barkley to be working under. So I'm excited to see if he can kind of continue this renaissance of his career there.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's move on to number two. I've got two powerhouses at one and two, and number two is Bayern Munich. Yeah, I mean, on a year when you failed to win the league, even with Harry Kane scoring at the rate he did, they've won nothing.
Potless, as you like to say.
They are potless, mate. And that's not okay. Okay, so they know that. They're like, right, we need a fix. What are we going to do? So we'll get a new centre back. Let's get the best defensive midfielder in the game right now, and let's get a young, exciting attacker. So they've just gone and like got, well, at least two of the best. Hirooki Ito is coming at centre back. I don't know exactly how highly you could rate him, but he's extremely good. And a couple of Premier League clubs have been looking at him as well. And
I rate him very highly for his worth.
Do you?
And
yeah.
I think that Ito and Anton as the centre-back partnership for Stuttgart last year is the reason they finished second in many ways. Obviously, Jurassic took a lot of the headlines, but they were defensively really good. And
yeah.
Anton's gone to Dortmund and Ito's gone to Bayern. So it's going to be very interesting to see how Stuttgart go about replacing them.
Oh, well, this is it as well. And obviously, like, Bayern had been signing big names for their defence, and, you know, De Ligt and Upamecano weren't, you know, didn't really live up to expectations. So perhaps this is a better way to be going.
Jonathan Tarr looks like he's going to go in there as well. Deal goes through to Manchester United. So it's going to be intriguing to see what this new partnership and what the pecking order looks like at Bayern next year, I think.
Absolutely. But they've certainly improved the depth and probably, like, just changed the mentality a bit too, because there was a bit too much negativity around the place. And by shaking up the centre of their defence, I think that's a really bold strategy, but probably a good one. Especially as they've now got João Palhinha playing in front of them. The best destroyer I've ever seen at Fulham. Like, the way that this guy covers ground, the way that he times his tackles, the way he picks his passes, he's second to none.
What's quite rare about Palhinha is that he is the kind of player, and I talk about this with Declan Rice quite a lot, right? Like, I think Declan Rice is a really good six, and I'm not 100% sure why he continues to demand that he's played in a different role, because I think his actual best work is often done at the base of midfield. Palhinha is a six who wants to play six. He loves tackling people. Mm. He loves going through people. He loves winning the ball back, and he loves getting it out to someone else. He likes splitting the centre backs. Like, he's really, really keen to do what he's supposed to do. And yeah. I think that's really important in this kind of role, because there are so many players who get put in this position. They're like, I don't want to play there. But yeah. Palhinha does. He wants to be that anchor for the entire team. And that's what he gets joy out of doing. And I think it frees up everybody else to be the best version of themselves.
Yeah, he'll pick up a few yellow cards along the way. But he's just unbelievable. He's 29 now. And to be honest, that's part of the reason I'm kind of okay with him leaving Fulham at this moment. I think, Jack, we might have had him for the best couple of years of his career. Like, I'm amazed that Fulham have just had him for the past two seasons, because he should have been playing for someone a lot higher up the food chain us. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But this also is a guy that I'm going to touch wood here just for his sake. He doesn't get injured. Like, he doesn't miss games unless he's suspended, which I'm not going to say doesn't happen, because it does. But
it only happens three times a year.
Exactly. He just picks up yellows. He doesn't go flying around getting, like, dodgy reds either. He's just hard but fair. And Bayern are going to love him. If they get the version of him that we've seen, they're going to absolutely love him. So that is just a brilliant signing. And to be honest, I don't begrudge him the move at all, even though he will be missed at the Cottage. They've got a pretty good deal on him as well, as far as I'm concerned. But Michael Olise is probably the one that everybody's really going to have eyes on. What does he do here? What kind of impact does he make going in at Bayern Munich? Now, it's interesting at the moment, because they've obviously they've had a bit of big outlay here. They've spent over 125 million euros already. They've also signed Brian Zaragoza. And they're also still looking at signing either Xavi Simons or Désiré Doué. I still can't pronounce his name, but something like that.
I'm absolutely maintaining that Tottenham must sign Désiré Doué, purely so they can have Destiny and Desire on one flank.
Well, they're really into him as well. And I was told last week that they felt they had an edge in this race. But since I was told that, and I'm glad I didn't write it, they haven't been in the conversation. It's been all about PSG and Bayern. So unless Spurs have got a trick up their sleeve here, which they may well have, I'm not sure that that's happening. But
we must have Desire and Destiny.
It would be a lot of fun.
For narrative FC purposes.
Yeah, but Michael Olise, we knew he'd make a big transfer from Crystal Palace this summer. I have to admit, I expected it to be within the Premier League, but he's stepping outside his comfort zone. He's going into a team which are going to win things. You know, what happened last season is not going to be repeated and repeated. They're going to have to up their game. They're going to have to improve, but he'll have so much hunger to go there and do it. And I can just see him tearing it up. It's going to be interesting to see exactly how he fits into the attack, exactly how he combines with those players that are in and around him. But I'd suggest he's going to have no problem at all.
Yeah, I think he's going to be absolutely fine. And I think watching how he develops this year is going to be one of the great joys of watching Bayern. But yeah, I mean, from a place, the place where they were, where things looked really, pretty bleak, this is a really strong start to the window in terms of just strengthening this squad, filling the gaps that they needed filling. And look, as much as Sané and Gnabry are brilliant footballers and I never want to take that away from them, I think it felt like it was probably time to be able to change things up. And with Zaragoza coming in, with Elise coming in, and also with Nestrier and Kudenka coming in, and I'm not sure if he's going to play that much. I think it's interesting to see how that one develops. Obviously coming in from the A-League, from Adelaide United, he's become, you know, incredibly highly rated over there. And some of the stuff he was doing in the A-League, especially in the knockout rounds, he was incredible in the playoffs. I'm really excited to see if that is. And look, it might be a couple of years in the second team for him as he gets up to speed with things and transfers that over. But what a fun signing to make on top of everything else to bring him in there from Adelaide. And I'm really excited to see how that one plays out.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that Bayern were hurt by what happened last season, and they have wasted no time at all in trying to fix things and getting back to where they feel they belong. And I think that they'll probably get there. At number one, I just had to go for Real Madrid.
Boring.
I just had boring. To. I mean, especially as the day that we're recording this, I'm literally waking up here in America to see all of the Mbappe tributes as he arrives at the Bernabeu and all the fans already worshipping him and all the words coming out from him. And it's just a magical signing. This is the best signing you're going to see all summer. This is the best player you could possibly sign. So they now have the best forward in the world, as far as I'm concerned. And they've also signed a player that could be the next to become the best in the world, because they got Endrick as well coming in. And that is a duo that honestly could shape the next 10 years of European football if these two can come together and rip it up like they really can. The Mbappe deal's obviously been about 10 years in the making, so it's not like it's a major surprise, but it's good because it's finally happened. We're finally at the point where we're seeing Mbappe in a Real Madrid shirt. They're hard to buy unless you're on the H-Goat, but you can't deny that this is the best signing you could have made. And as a result, Real Madrid are just going to hit new levels. Now, Barcelona are going to try and match them, obviously, and they're going to try and do some sparky business of their own, and they'll try and get Nico Williams or something like that. So there might yet be some real fun to be had in La Liga. But that's what we want. Like, what we're seeing right now with the arrival of Mbappe takes La Liga back to where it needs to be. It's fallen off the radar in the last couple of years in terms of a universal feel. People haven't cared as much about watching Real Madrid and Barcelona because the glitz and glamour just hasn't been there. The competitiveness hasn't been at the same level. I want proper rivalries back, and we're going to get it.
Everyone's been sleeping on La Liga, and then suddenly when Yarrabal turns up in the European Championship final and Lenormand drops another absolute stormer and Zubimendi decides that he's going to come on for Rodri and be just as good, everyone's like, who are these guys? But hey, it was there under your noses all along.
Yeah, exactly. But this is really good for Spanish football. This is a big moment in European football. And yeah, as I say, when I'm putting this together and you're thinking, right, what's the best transfer business so far? At first, I didn't even really have Real Madrid in my head as one of the clubs, because I was just looking at the deals that have been done. And I was like, hang on, Real Madrid about to unveil Kylian Mbappe and Endrick's going in there as well. Like, I can't ignore this. It's the best transfer business anyone's done.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to open, when I originally had a ranking for this, I was going to say you do the Premier League and I do Europe. And I was going to open mine and be like, let's leave Real Madrid out.
That's very Jack Kylian and this is Mbappe very Dean.
And Endrick. But look, I mean, obviously it's incredible. It's going to be very intriguing to see how the balance works and how Mbappe fits in there at Real Madrid and what that looks like. Obviously a very poor European championships from him. And I think ultimately he'll be in most people's disappointing 11s from the European championships. Obviously he broke his nose and that's obviously not great, but equally, I think you'd expect more from Kylian Mbappe than what he put on show in these Euros. So yes, obviously it's incredibly exciting, but I think also there are question marks about how he's going to fit, how it's going to work. And all of that is yet to be addressed. Obviously, Real Madrid don't really need to do anything else. I wonder if they go back in for Fonzi Davis, and was one that was obviously bubbling around in April, etc. But we'll see what comes of that. But generally,
I mean, you can't really knock bringing in Mbappe and then Endrick, who, you know, the best player in the world and the player who could become the best player in the world. As you said, it's hard to kind of look at it and think anything, but that's pretty special as a window. You know, on the whole, we're seeing a lot of the youngsters sort of moving on. Rafa Marin, who obviously went out on loan last year to Alaves, has gone off to Napoli. But as you expect with all of these, when their youngsters go out, it just comes to that point where you go, well, they're going to have a buyback, aren't they? So if he absolutely slams it, Rafa Marin, then suddenly you'd expect that in 3 years' time he'll be back at Real Madrid anyway. So, yeah, I mean, it's hard to disagree with it. It's hard to look at it and think anything, but this could be pretty special.
Yeah, what else is on your radar, mate?
Well, I got a couple of honourable mentions, and I wanted to just bring up both Benfica and Lyon, because I think both have started this window really sensibly. So Benfica's big headline move is they brought in Vangelis Pavlidis, who I've been banging on about for ages, who I think has been absolutely wonderful for AZ in the Eredivisie. Now, Benfica have had a problem, obviously, replacing the goals of Gonzalo Ramos, who has struggled himself since obviously leaving the club, but it didn't feel like anyone was able to step up. Arthur Cabral came in. That didn't really go to plan. They've struggled to find the players that are going to go in there and make a difference. And I think Pavlidis comes in there now as undisputed number nine, obviously an incredible amount of goals in the Netherlands last year. He's had a really good couple of years, a sort of windy path to the top, but he's really got there now. And I'm excited to see how he gets on in the Primera, because I think he could bang them in for fun. They signed Rollheiser, who was on loan there last year from Estudiantes. And he's been very, very good in very short spurts. But I'm excited to see what he can do in with kind of more minutes. And at 24, he should be starting to come into his prime now. And Jan-Niklas Bester, which I think is a brilliant signing. They brought him in from Heidenheim. He was really, really impressive. Very, very creative. One of the top assist providers in the Bundesliga for Heidenheim last year. And when he kind of kicks into gear, I think that's a kind of wing striker combination in Pavlidis and Bester that should really work well together. There's something there, I think, that everyone can cling on to. And then there's Barreiro, who they brought in from Mainz, who should just add a bit of steel to that central midfield, you know, center and where it's coming from. So I think they've done some really nice business here. Obviously, they've lost Rafa Silva, who's gone off to Besiktas on a free transfer. Obviously, Angel Di Maria has left the club now as well. So there's a lot to kind of, okay, we've got to deal with these and deal with these issues. But I think they've come into this with two wingers who I'm really excited about. One who is obviously there on loan, a striker I'm really excited about, and a central midfielder who I think is excellent. And they've brought in a centre-back in Gustavo Marquez, who, to be honest, I don't know loads about, but a player that I think is very interesting in terms of they've picked him up from America in Serie B. So it's not even a top flight Brazilian centre-back in terms of playing in the Brasileiro, but someone who has a very good physical profile and I think is going to be interesting to keep an eye on. So one to look out for there from Benfica. And Lyon are on a bit of a charge, which is exciting. Now, they've basically charged straight at Nottingham Forest. Obviously, they had Oro Mangala last year on loan. They've bought him and then they went back in for Moussa Niakate, which I think is a really, really good addition to their centre-back core. Obviously, we've been looking at what's happened there, and Jake O'Brien's been absolutely sensational since moving there from Crystal Palace, become a full Ireland international now. Very exciting. That was a €1 million deal, I think it ended up being, and he's really shone for Lyon. Obviously, they had that charge up the table in the second half of the season. They've made a couple of those deals permanent, the likes of Saeed Benrahma and obviously, you know, Mangala, as we said. They've brought in Abner Vinicius at left back from Betis. They've brought in Mama Balde, which is an interesting one. He was on loan there last year. I wasn't hugely impressed with him, but he's been made permanent at this point. So that's exciting. But more than that, they've also now swooped in to take one of the stars of the Euros, Georges Mikaudadze, off Monaco. Monaco had the medical booked. They had the fee agreed. It all looked really cozy. But Mikaudadze was in the Lyon Academy from the ages of 8 to 15. Before moving to Metz.
Oh,
and he went to Ajax, came back, and obviously Lyon have swooped in and brought in a striker who I've been very excited about for a little while now. Was very excited when he moved to Ajax. He didn't get the opportunity, went back to Metz, was absolutely sensational, and then has had a brilliant tournament for Georgia as well here at the Euros. So I think this is a really cool move. He has a lot of the attributes you want from a top level forward. I think he could really cook in this Lyon team. So I think it's been a really good window so far, and I'm excited to see what's gonna go down with Lyon next year. And I hope they can keep up that charge that they put in the second half of the season, because when they did so, they were basically bar for bar with PSG. Just happened they were coming from a relegation spot. PSG were coming from top of the table. But when you look at their points per game, et cetera, in the second half of the season, Lyon right up there. So I'm hoping they can continue that on and they can challenge this season.
Absolutely. Just to end the segment, I just had a tweet flash up on my phone from the famous Christian Falk, who says, Trent Alexander-Arnold is wanted by Real Madrid. Now that really would underline Real Madrid going in at number one in this ranking.
Yeah, that one would change things, I think. I mean, good luck getting in front of Danny Carvajal in this kind of form is probably what I would say to Trent in that.
Maybe play midfield, mate. Creative midfielder.
Try and get in that midfield anyway. I mean,
it's
either
the new Toni Kroos.
It's not an easy task, whichever way you play at it. So it is what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. But that was fun, mate. Enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it too. Thank you very much for setting that up. It's all very, very exciting. Right, in part three, got a little bit of guru wisdom for you. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Ranks FC, where it's time for a little bit of
guru wisdom, guru wisdom, guru wisdom.
What guru wisdom have you got for us from the States this week, DJ?
Well, firstly, I want to thank everybody for getting in touch last week after my tipping dilemma continued. I have started to improve. I have started to get used to it. I still don't like the fact that the server or whoever can see the screen and see what you're doing in that moment. And like, it feels like you're disrespecting them in some way if you just press custom tip zero. But I've started to do it, especially when I'm just buying a coffee or something. And last night I had a bit of a dilemma because I went to a restaurant and the service really wasn't that good, but I really felt that she was a nice girl and she was clearly like quite stressed. So I still ended up giving her the 20% I know you're expected to get, but with every inch of my English bones, it really hurt to give her a 20% tip when she really hadn't done a very good job at the actual service because we sat there for ages with no food or drinks. But it's okay because I watched the baseball called the home run derby, not derby, Jack, derby, the home run derby.
What's
that? Well, it's like this all-star thing where they just like get like, it's like having, if you had in the Premier League, 10 of the best penalty takers and you go to Wembley and the stadium's full, like they sell out every ticket and you just go head to head and you get like 50 penalties and you would just be see who scores the most penalties. And like, you basically get like, I don't know how many hits it was, might have been 40 hits. And how many home runs you get out of those hits. First time I've ever seen it. Americans will be laughing listening to my description of it now because it's probably completely wrong. But yeah, it was something. I was just like, this is literally the equivalent of the Premier League sending up 10 good penalty takers and we just like say, right, who's the best at them? And you just like take pens. It's so funny. But yeah, it got me through waiting for my server. So bring me my actual food, mate. Guru wisdom this week is another American dilemma. When you move out here to start a new life, which is basically what I'm doing in some terms, you know, I've had to come here and start afresh. Obviously, Taylor's got a history here, but it's a while ago. It's difficult because everything you need to do, you can't actually do until you've got the other thing. So say you need to open a bank account. Well, to open a bank account, you need an address. I don't have an address yet. Well, I do now. I'm about to move today, but it didn't have a postal address. You also need a social security number. Well, you've got to wait for that to come in the post when you arrived. Didn't have that. And most places also want a phone number. Well, I don't have a US phone number yet, and they don't accept an English one. So I'm like, okay, well, what I'll do is the first thing I'll do is just get an American phone number. Like, that'll be the best way to start off. So you start doing it. And they're like, okay, what's your zip code? I haven't got a zip code. I don't live here yet. Like, I just got here. And it's like, okay. So then you get through that eventually. And they're like, right, let's run your credit report. Well, I haven't got a credit report, have I? There's no trace of me in this country. So you fail the credit report because you've got no credit. Okay, so I can't get a phone. Well, let's try and get the internet because I'm like, I'm going to need the internet. Start going through the internet. Like, obviously, once you've got the address, I've finally got an address, which wasn't easy to get either. That was the other thing, by the way. Finally got an address, agreed a rent. What happens next? got to pay your first month's rent. My bank card had worked for everything else, right? Everything I've bought, absolutely fine. Go to pay the first month's rent and the deposit. Nah, not having it, is it? Not accepted. Contact your card issuer. I can't contact my card issuer. It's 2 o'clock in the morning in England and this card's been fine. Oh, mate, it's
you have
been
to Venmo
such...
them it. Venmo is my favourite thing that I don't know anything about, I think.
Can't Venmo it. But what I had to do in the end was like basically transfer to Taylor's old US account and she's done it from there, blah, blah, blah. But basically, it's this like circle of doom, cell phone number, postal address, zip code, social security numbers, credit scores. And you can't get one thing without the other. So I'm just going round and round in circles trying to get all of them and can't get any. So today, Jack, we're going to finally move into our new home. Say finally, I've only been here 2 and a bit weeks, so I've done it reasonably quick. We've done all right.
Yeah, you've done okay.
But yeah, I'm quite pleased with that. But so we've got the address. Taylor's managed to sort out the internet on her own thing. So we're going to have the internet. Taylor's managed to sort out the car. So we've got a car. But I really have got to get a cell phone. So anyone's got any advice on that? Let me know. Anyone can help me open a bank account? Let me know. Anyone that's got any spare money they want to lend me? Let me know.
Honestly, I think we should rename the Guru Wisdom section just Dean asking for tips. This is what
Dean's
become.
American Nightmare. Maybe we should call it that. Oh, same, no. I'm having a great time, but the admin side of it, I haven't enjoyed at all.
No, I can probably see that, mate. I'll be honest. I feel like we're in a space.
It's been
there
so.
That I can
it's just like the only like people are like, how's the move? Has it been stressful? And honestly, we've done really well. I mean, Tay's been great at organising it all and stuff. And like our stuff all arrived like 2 days after we landed in America. All of our boxes arrived, and we stuck them in storage. That was all great. Like, you know, 9 out of 10 things have gone as well
perfectly
as we could have hoped.
Yeah.
But this like admin and paying for stuff and getting bank cards and stuff is absolutely driving me mad. So
you are currently in the spinning circle of death.
I really am.
Wheel of death.
I think I'm going to get an eSIM for my phone.
Yeah, that works.
And it works, but I'm just terrified of losing all my WhatsApp. Like my WhatsApp is my life, literally. All my friends and all my work comes through WhatsApp. And I think it's going to be fine. I think it literally, as soon as this eSIM will just like override.
You've got
it
an old phone. That's what I would do. I'd do an eSIM on an old phone.
I do. It's a terrible phone. Dylan uses it to play Roblox, but yeah, I guess I could try it.
That's probably the move.
You could try it. Yeah. Taylor's just done hers and hers worked okay. So in the next week, you'll probably get a little notification on your WhatsApp to say Dean has a new number.
I was waiting for it, to be honest. I was interested to see how it came across.
Yeah. It's just at the moment, I'm just, getting by on vibes, mate, rather than any phone service. Everywhere I go, I'm just like, has it got free Wi-Fi? Has it got any Wi-Fi I can hook up to? It's pathetic, really. I'm like a 14-year-old boy running around the town.
You're basically on like a traveling tour, what they call backpacking.
Yeah, it feels
you're interrailing around Europe, basically searching for hotspots. I've been in this world.
I really am. There's even this good eSIM that I've had before out here called Airolo, which you basically just get like a 30-day package on or whatever. And I moved here. I was like, I'll just do that straight away. It didn't work. And if it doesn't work the first time, it basically won't work. And I messed it up. It was my fault. And I was like, oh my God, I wasn't focusing. And I've now lost the page. And it's just gone. Like that will not work again. So that didn't help. I promise I'm having a good time. It's lovely, aren't you? Yeah. I've eaten a lot of pizza, I'll give you that much.
The only time you ever complain is actually in this segment on the podcast. Everything else has been absolutely perfect.
Well, so, I figure it's quite entertaining to hear an Englishman moan about being abroad.
Yeah, absolutely. Very Carl Pilkington vibes. I think we probably should call this a day. So all that's left for me to do is say thank you very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC. We hope you've enjoyed yourselves listening to this episode. Thank you so much, as ever, for tuning in. And we'll be back very shortly, Ranks Squad. Take it easy. Peace.